You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic, yeah. It's atomic.
Hello?
Good evening, Professor Ewing. How are you?
Just fine.
How is my sound over at your end?
It's fine.
Okay, good.
This is Rod Adams.
This is Rod Adams, and I'd like to introduce you, and then we'll begin chatting. Tonight on the Atomic Show, or today on the Atomic Show, whenever you happen to be listening to it, I'm going to be talking with Professor Rodney Ewing. He's a professor in the Department of Nuclear Engineering and Geology. Is that correct?
That's right.
At the University of Michigan. And Professor Ewing has been studying the safe disposal of nuclear waste materials for probably about 25 years. Is that correct, sir?
Something like that, yes.
And Professor Ewing agreed to come on the show and chat with us about his research and his feelings about the use of nuclear power. I've been doing a little reading on some of your research, and it looks like one of your main efforts over the years has been the development of a rather unique material designed to immobilize plutonium and, I assume, other aconite materials. Can you tell us a little about that? Let's see, what is it called here?
Pyrochlor?
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah. Well, a major research effort in our group and with colleagues at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory has been to study radiation effects in complex ceramics. And so we've been looking at materials that are able to incorporate actinides, particularly plutonium, and that also might be resistant to radiation damage. And so in the late 1990s, studying this material called pyrochlor, we discovered that by changing the composition, we could increase the resistance of the material to radiation damage. And this turned out to be very important for plutonium immobilization because plutonium decays by alpha decay, emitting an alpha particle, and then there's a recoil nucleus. And this causes substantial damage to materials that are used to incorporate plutonium. And the material that we discovered undergoes a certain type of transformation, but it recovers very quickly from the damage, and so we would describe it as radiation resistant.
So it almost heals itself?
Yes, it anneals itself at essentially room temperature, and so it would remain crystalline for really tens, if not hundreds of thousands of years.
Very interesting. So you've also been involved over the years in the study of the geology at Yucca Mountain, the proposed site for disposal of used nuclear fuel in the U.S.
Right.
And according to some of the articles I've read, you have some questions about whether or not that's really the right place to be looking at storing to use nuclear fuel?
Well, the work we've done is focused not so much on the question of whether it's the right place, but on some of the issues related to the stability of spent fuel under the conditions that one would expect at Yucca Mountain. And so as an example, at Yucca Mountain, because the conditions are oxidizing, the fuel will alter. The uranium, which is typically in a reduced state, 4+, would oxidize to 6+ and form a wide variety of uranium phases. So our work has focused on studying those phases, and the main focus right now is to determine whether the corrosion products or these alteration phases might incorporate some of the released radionuclides, such as neptunium. The question is, would the neptunium substitute into the structure of these uranium compounds and as a result be held up, as it were, or retarded in their mobility, be kept in the waste package?
Well, I personally have some questions about whether or not burying the used nuclear fuel underground is the right thing to do with the material, particularly since there seems to be so much leftover potential energy in that material.
Right.
And I also wonder if, you know, based on the kinds of things you're talking about, and I guess the oxidizing environment is something that would occur later on after the material got wet. Because, I mean...
It's the environment is oxidizing immediately.
Isn't the material stored in a container?
Right, but the waste... Well, when I say immediately, you're right. It wouldn't experience oxidizing conditions until the waste package is breached.
Okay. Yeah, so at some point in the future, I guess the storage container is assumed to be... breached or penetrated through some mechanism?
Well, just by various corrosion mechanisms, and there are a number of possibilities, but over very long periods of time, one, I think, finally has to assume that the waste package is breached and the fuel is exposed to the ambient conditions.
It seems to me that those kinds of things start to go into almost a little bit of projections or guesswork way out in the future, because you know there are containers that are still around on this earth that are several thousand years old that are ceramic materials that don't seem to have been damaged too much by their storage. Ming vases or something like that, which are pretty fragile, but still around. Of course, we don't have a very long recorded history to look at for those kinds of things.
Well, and also, you have a bias sample. You don't have what's now gone.
True. So, all you have is what's left over, right?
Right. So... there are good examples, both man-made objects and natural materials that certainly have lasted for long periods of time. And in fact, that's a whole area of research where people look at minerals that are very durable and then model waste forms after those minerals in terms of the structure and composition.
Mm-hmm.
Or look for metals or man-made materials that are very durable and then try to model waste package materials to kind of mimic the positive qualities of these materials.
Now, there's also an analog that a lot of scientists have studied specifically with regard to spent nuclear fuel, the natural reactor at Oklo. Have you done any work in that area?
Yes, we've had a number of people in our group work on Oklo material, and the main point there is that Oklo provides evidence for, you know, the retention of radionuclides, but the conditions at Oklo are reducing. So under reducing conditions, uranium oxide, like the uranium oxide you'd have in spent fuel, is very durable.
Mm-hmm.
And so it in fact persists for many hundreds of millions of years. So that's an example of how the geochemical conditions can improve the probability or the possibility that materials are retained in, you know, in the near field, in a repository or in this natural locality.
Well, I'll have to admit that my chemistry background is a little bit back in the future or back in the past, and I got to scrape off some rust. Can you help me refresh what the difference between an oxidizing environment and a reducing environment is, and what we would have to do to choose a reducing environment?
Yeah, an oxidizing environment, just as the phrase indicates, is one in which you have oxygen in concentration, say, typical of what we have at the surface of the Earth. And so for an element like uranium, which has two oxidation states, plus four and plus six, under oxidizing conditions, that uranium becomes plus six. And as it happens, the plus six form of uranium and the chemical compounds or complexes that form are much more soluble than the plus four. So the UO2, the uranium dioxide that's in reactor fuels, under reducing conditions is very stable as long as you can keep it in that reduced oxidation state. But under oxidizing conditions, UO2 is not stable, and in fact pretty rapidly can be corroded. In terms of, you know, solubilities, it's about a 3 or 4 order of magnitude difference. The way you can maintain reducing conditions is the presence of a lot of organic material. And at Oklo, this is certainly the case. The uranium is intimately associated with organic compounds, and the organic compounds help maintain reducing conditions. There are other geologic environments, say below the water table in granite, such as the repositories that are proposed in Sweden or Finland, where the sulfides, iron sulfides, keep the conditions of the groundwater in a reducing state and thereby improve the performance.
That kind of begs the question of why is Yucca Mountain the only place that the U.S. is looking, if it has such an environment that doesn't provide the possibility of a reducing state?
Well, there's a long history and, of course, various interpretations of that history. The short version of the story is when Yucca Mountain was selected as the single site for characterization. On the political side, I think the driving force was that at that time they were trying to characterize three sites, sites in Richland, Washington, and a site in Texas, in Bedded Salt, in Deaf Smith County. But the cost of characterizing three sites was large, and so the idea was to select a single site for characterization. And I think at the time when they were selecting a single site, what was attractive about Yucca Mountain was, one, the idea that it's dry, because in the absence of water as a transporting medium, then materials should stay in place. And then also the fact that it was in a remote and isolated place associated or near the Nevada test site where, there had already been contamination from nuclear weapons. And so it seemed like both geologically and, let's say, politically a reasonable decision. Now, since that time, of course, we've learned a lot more about the site, and although it's a desert environment and observatory horizon is located well above the water table, the rock is, in fact, has a high porosity. And there's a fair amount of water held in that porosity. So the mountain has considerable amount of water held in the high porosity of this volcanic tuff. So it's dry to the touch, but it's not a case where there's no water present. So that information developed over years of study, combined with now an appreciation for the important role of the redox conditions, have made the work at Yucca Mountain or the evaluation of its performance, I think, more complicated.
Yeah, and pretty expensive, I guess. I think we spent about $6 billion out there so far.
I don't know the latest figure, but I think it's pushing something like $8 billion up until now.
That seems to be an awful lot of money to spend when the material that we're talking about disposing of has not done anybody any harm where it is right now.
Right, and of course some of the proposals are to store it on site around the country, and one can appreciate that the people in those areas aren't so enthusiastic about that and would like to have it moved off-site to a more secure locality.
Well, I've been at a few of the operating reactor sites, and I don't have any real questions about their security.
Right.
The amount of effort it takes to get into one, even as a cleared individual, is pretty substantial.
Right. But I think the concern of the communities is the idea that if, you know, Yucca Mountain isn't making good progress, or if there's not a repository, over the long term, you know, they may become mini storage facilities.
Agreed. However, there is a pressing need within our current economy to figure out ways to generate the power that we like to use without producing emissions, and it seems like nuclear has a leg up on all the other alternatives in that area.
It certainly does not produce greenhouse gases, so that's a big positive. And of course, the renewed enthusiasm for nuclear power is, in I think, large part generated by the interest in energy sources that don't generate these greenhouse gases. The point, though, from my perspective, is that if nuclear power is a major part of the answer to reducing CO2 emissions and related greenhouse gases, we have to think about the scale of what that renewed or nuclear power, increased nuclear power, would look like. And it's pretty impressive what's required in order to have an impact on the greenhouse gas emissions. So the constraints are as follows. Roughly, whatever the solution is to greenhouse gases, we need it to come online pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So typically people speak of keeping greenhouse gas emissions to twice that of pre-industrial levels, so something around 550 parts per million. We're at 370 parts per million now. And restricting it to that doubling by the year 2050. So 2050 is, at least for the sake of discussion, a good time period to consider. And in order for nuclear power to really displace a lot of the power production associated with burning hydrocarbons, then it has to expand on a scale, it depends on the study, but on a scale of a factor of 3 to 10. Well, if we take the lower figure, factor of 3, that means we need something like 1,200 new nuclear power plants by the year 2050.
Okay.
And that seems to me unlikely.
Well, what are some of the other alternatives? If you talk about expanding something on a particular scale, it would seem like expanding wind or solar to displace the same amount of fossil fuel generation as building 1,200 new nuclear plants would be an enormous task.
Right. So I think, you know, the best thinking in this area is to, it's clear it's going to require a combination of approaches. One that I think is not discussed often enough is first just conservation.
Oh, that's discussed all the time, sir. I mean, we've been reading about conservation since Amory Lovins published The Soft Energy Path in 1972.
Right, but I simply said it's not discussed still often enough. And so, as an example, some of the projections that are used to as part of the discussion of increased nuclear power see the population of the world rising to 9 billion, use figures such as raising the per capita consumption of energy by something like 50%, and these are, you know, part of the discussion about the need for additional energy, including nuclear energy. And so what I would like to see is a combined approach where conservation and reduction in the use of energy would be just as important as developing new energy sources. So, and part of the new energy sources would be, I think, expanded nuclear power. But I can't imagine that it can be expanded quickly enough or on a scale large enough to be the sole answer to greenhouse gas emissions. The other alternatives are also, you know, they're tough calls. I think the alternatives like wind, biomass, they haven't proven or haven't developed as quickly as one might have hoped. Despite pretty substantial investments over the last 10 or 15 years.
Right. And both of those are actually rather ancient power sources. I mean, humans have been using wind power and biomass almost as long as there have been humans.
Right, right.
I mean, biomass is another fancy word for burning wood.
Right.
Or grass or something.
There are large communities of people who believe that they have new approaches that can be scaled up and be an important player. And, you know, just as with nuclear, to scale them up to meet the problem, it's hard to imagine that any of these energy sources by themselves would be the answer. For the hydrocarbons, of course, there's lots of discussion of carbon sequestration. You know, you go ahead and use the hydrocarbon resource, but strip the carbon out and put it somewhere. So the talk, I think, that I gave at the Geological Society of America and that, you know, led to our present discussion was a talk in which I just asked the question, well, if we have hydrocarbons on one hand and nuclear on the other, and we link them together, how much of the hydrocarbon energy source can I replace with nuclear, and what would nuclear look like? And what's interesting in the kind of simple version of the analysis is that you're finally left with the question of plutonium versus carbon. That is, which do you want to deal with? Gigatons of carbon and carbon sequestration programs are thousands of metric tons of plutonium, which either could be recycled, but it really requires reprocessing and recycling and fabrication of fuels on a huge scale, and all the problems associated with it. Which do you prefer, the thousands of metric tons of plutonium or the gigatons of carbon? And it's a I don't have the answer for that question.
Well, it seems...
Sorry?
I just was, you know, on the scale of trying to store the carbon dioxide gas that is produced by a single large coal-fired facility is rather enormous. I mean, it produces, I think, 1,000 megawatt coal-fired plant produces about 40,000 tons of carbon dioxide gas every single day.
Right.
And if you are concerned about the ability of a geological formation to retain plutonium, how are we going to have a geological formation that's going to retain that kind of volume of gas that's produced every day by one plant and have enough to store the gases that are produced by, what do we burn, about 4 billion tons of coal in the world every year?
Right, right. No, I don't dispute the scale of the difficulty. And it's also, you know, I've just a few years ago started going to carbon sequestration meetings and listening to some of the ideas, and the tone of the meetings actually isn't too different from the discussions 20 or 30 years having to do with nuclear waste, where people were very optimistic about their ability to put the waste in the ground and that could be done quickly and efficiently and without much controversy. I think the same optimism is perhaps coloring the discussion now is in terms of carbon sequestration. And so looking at the scale of the problem, one might be led to say, well, let's deal with reprocessing plutonium. At least the plutonium can be used as a source of energy. We can have the recycling that will prolong the resources needed for nuclear power. But then the question, I think, becomes the security of the fissile material and the increased possibility of diversion of material into nuclear weapons. And so that, for me, finally becomes the critical issue with nuclear power. I think the waste problem, it still needs a lot of attention. And in terms of nuclear waste and repository sites, it's certainly possible to do still a poor job of it. But in fact, we know quite a lot, and I'm pretty confident that with concerted effort and thoughtful analysis of sites and all, I think that can be handled. So direct disposal, that's okay, but reprocessing on a scale that's required to meet the greenhouse gas emissions creates a traffic of fissile material that really is substantial, and so my concern is for diversion of that fissile material.
What about some of the recycling processes that never result in separated plutonium? The IFR, for example, all of the recycled material stayed within that plant itself and never left, so there was no traffic of the material, no movement outside of a secure area.
On a small scale, I think that's a possible solution, and also simply changing reactor designs so that you go to much higher burnups, and maybe, you know, the fuel never comes out of the reactor.
That's my best idea, is just use the fuel in the same reactor until you really use it up. Don't take it out when it's still got 95% of its potential energy left
right.
in it.
So those are possibilities, but of course, one of the reasons for reprocessing is to extend the resource in terms of fissile material. So the proven reserves of uranium, well, the figures always vary a little bit, but I think it's around 30 million tons now. So this would mean that, you know, once through burn-up, leaving it, say, in a reactor, are once through burn up and then directly into a repository, the resources really aren't available for a very extended scale up of nuclear power.
Well, that's if you assume that you still only get about 80,000 megawatt days per ton, but
right.
That's only a very small percentage of burn up. It's possible
right.
to get that burn up many, many times greater than that.
So what do you think what kinds of burn-ups are you talking about then?
Well, I'm aware of some that are as high as 600,000 megawatt days per ton.
600,000, let's see, megawatt days per ton.
Complete burn-up would be 1 million right. megawatt days right. per ton.
Right.
So
and
using
what types of reactors? I mean,
there are reactors in operation today that achieve that.
And so you would never refuel?
That's correct. The reactors I'm referring to last for 30 years without refueling.
Uh-huh. And you're thinking of submarines? Or?
That's correct, yes.
Right.
Now, of course, they use a specialized kind of reactor, but there
right,
are...
Right, special fuel.
Right, but there are other... reactors were designed with completely different philosophies. The last core of the shipping port reactor, for example, used a seed and blanket design that produced, it was a converter reactor. It did show actual light water breeding, but it was a very, very small amount of breeding. It conversion ratio was just slightly greater than one. So that reactor could have run for a very long time.
Right.
And I believe that there is an organization called Thorium Power, which is developing that reactor design.
Right.
It was initially, I think it was Radkowski was the man's name who invented
well,
it for.
Of course, the thorium fuel cycle has a lot of attractive qualities.
Sure, it does.
Electronics, as I understand, for uranium-233 are attractive. And actually, as a waste form, thorium oxide is great, much better than UO2 because the thorium doesn't have these two oxidation states, and so it's not sensitive to redox or the oxidizing conditions.
Right, and there's about four times as much thorium in the world as there is uranium.
Right, but there you have to be careful. In terms of uranium, what you're referring to is the crustal abundance of thorium versus uranium. Uranium's
yes.
On average maybe 3 parts per million. I think thorium's 10. But thorium deposits are actually pretty rare as compared to uranium. And they're rare because the thorium with this single oxidation state, there aren't geochemical processes that lead to it being concentrated into ore deposits.
Okay.
So a country like India has thorium deposits, but they're pretty unique. And, so that the thorium reserves around the world in terms of mineable deposits that you could rely on are much more limited than the uranium.
Interesting. Now, one of the questions that comes to my mind, and you did mention that you thought that increasing the per capita rate of energy use is something that you would prefer not to see, but I've traveled to a lot of countries where the people there use almost no energy at all, and
right.
they're countries that are very highly populated, and it seems to me it's almost... unconscionable for me as a comfortable United States citizen to think about denying those people the ability to flip on a light switch or turn on a stove or those kinds of things.
Right, and I don't disagree with the observation, but I just add that, the United States is accounting for an enormous fraction of both the energy consumption and the release of greenhouse gases. So there's a lot we could do in our advanced society to reduce these emissions. Now, those efforts might be swamped by the population and the per capita increases in countries like India and China, but right now we're the major problem.
Yeah, we're certainly a large part of the problem, and
about a quarter of the problem.
Yes, but a large portion of our greenhouse gas emissions, I believe it's at least 30%, comes from our coal-fired power plants.
Right.
And if we had continued building nuclear power plants simply at the rate that we did in the 1970s, we wouldn't be using any coal at all today.
Even with the increased consumption of energy.
Even with the increased consumption of energy. Because today, our nuclear power plants in the U.S. produce 20% of our electricity, about 780 gigawatt hours or something like that, I think is the number. Terawatt hours, sorry, 780 terawatt hours of electricity. And we basically stopped building 30 years ago.
And how many power plants then would we have today?
In order to produce the power that would eliminate coal-fired burning, we would have about 350.
So it'd be a factor of three, roughly.
Yes. Yeah.
So that would be, let me just think here. That would be about 7,000 metric tons of spent fuel per year.
If we continued at our current burn up, that's correct.
Right. Right.
And I, again, the scale of the numbers is pretty incredible because right now we burn a billion tons of coal per year, producing 4 billion tons of CO2, plus a few other minor pollutants like nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide,
right,
mercury, etc., that doesn't get produced.
The radiation exposure from burning the coal is greater than from nuclear power plants.
Yes, because of the contamination of the coal with those thorium and uranium materials.
But at that rate, okay, so that's 7,000 metric tons, so that adds up pretty quickly. That would mean that's over the last 30 years, right?
Yep.
So then we would have needed, in that time period, three more Yucca Mountains.
Assuming that we didn't do any kind of recycling or increasing the burn-up.
Right.
I mean,
even if you double the burn-up, what you see is our actual experience with developing repositories so that we can dispose of the fuel wouldn't match the problem that would have been generated.
I believe that if we had continued building, we would probably have also continued to think about recycling. I mean, we actually had a couple of recycling plants just getting ready to come online when the President Ford decided to put a temporary ban, and then Carter made it permanent.
Right, but Reagan lifted that.
Right, after the industry had already gone broke by the stroke of an executive's pen.
Do you think Carter caused the industry to go broke?
No, I mean the recycling industry.
Right.
He outlawed the ability to recycle used nuclear fuel. So the people that had invested several billion dollars up to that point had an asset that they couldn't use. There was no other use for that stuff.
But do you think that's fair? I mean, the reprocessing plants, the experience at Barnwell, and there was another, I think, in Illinois. Is that right?
It was one up in New York. I'm not sure there was one in Illinois.
Right, at West Valley.
Correct.
But we had about three goes at reprocessing, and some of these plants never came online because of technical difficulties and also the economics of just using mined uranium rather than reprocessing.
Well, Barnwell didn't ever come online. It was
right.
Just about completed in 1976.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it didn't come online, but it didn't come online because it was suddenly outlawed.
Well, but before Barnwell, there were other reprocessing plants that simply failed, right?
Oh, sure. But that's the way technology works. There's lots of computers that don't work very well in the first generation. There's lots of automobiles whose first generation is not the best. It just it takes time to develop good machinery. I mean, we've learned a lot in operating the nuclear power plants we have today. They operate far more reliably now than they did when they were first constructed.
Right. But I mean, my point is that it's not probably entirely fair to blame this on Carter. I mean, there were lots of technical failures that preceded his executive order.
That's correct.
Right.
Yeah.
And when it's been some time since Reagan lifted that ban, and you know, the industry really hasn't responded by, I would say, any interest in reprocessing. It's only very recently, with the Advanced Fuel Cycle Initiative, that there's been much interest, and that's, you know, mainly from the government side.
The government's interested partially because there have been some private individuals who have been talking about it for many years, not necessarily the industry. The industry, as you say, is not particularly interested in investing in something that they know, you know, like any other industry, it is cheaper to use virgin material than it is to use recycled material. Without a lot of pressure, most industries don't like to produce new products from used material. I mean, that paper recycling industry wouldn't be very big without a lot of pressure. Now, that's not true in some cases. Obviously, people have figured out that recycling aluminum is a good deal for everybody.
Right.
And recycling automobiles is a good deal for everybody. It's, you know, there's scrap dealers all over.
Here, I'm not an expert, and I think we're both maybe speculating a lot, but one thing I've wondered about is the nuclear power industry has been really reticent to invest in the research and development and you know, to take a chance, say, on reprocessing. And yet the petroleum industry, the exploration for oil, you know, in the Gulf of Mexico, North Sea, I mean, these are really, you know, it's risky business with a lot of investment.
Agreed.
And so I wonder why the nuclear power industry hasn't been as aggressive as other energy sectors in developing energy resources and supporting research in these areas and so on.
Well, that's a great question. And I'm not an expert, but I have done quite a bit of research in this particular area. And one is that one reason is that the nuclear power industry in general, the people that operate nuclear power plants, are risk-averse utilities who are used to and involved in an industry where they are a regulated monopoly with a defined rate of return. And if they actually do things to increase their productivity, they don't really see an increased profit. There are some utilities today that have to sell their electricity at a cost far below the market value because the regulated rate of return on their investment tells them that they're making a adequate profit at 3 or 4 cents per kilowatt hour, even though the market price for that electricity is 7 or 8 cents a kilowatt hour on the wholesale market.
But that still doesn't, to me, explain the lack of investment in research and development over the long term.
Well, the difference is in the oil industry, you do have the opportunities for massive quantities of cash if you receive a big hit. In the nuclear industry, there is no opportunity for massive profits. there are good profits. There are profits that pay good dividends to your stockholders, but there's not the ability to go for the home run. And in the oil industry, the home run is always available, as is seen by recent profit statements in the oil and gas industry. Of course, they can also strike out.
Right, and but the strikeout rate's pretty high for wildcat wells.
Absolutely, but that's, I mean, as an investor myself, you know, if you can't hit a home run, you're not going to swing very hard. If you can hit a home run, you will take the opportunity and occasionally strike out. So that's, I mean, again, people who are wanting risky investments and research and development into new areas is often risky, are not the kind of people that invest in utilities.
Well, now, again, this is, I think, from both our sides, speculation, but because I'm in both communities, and there are big differences. I mean, the petroleum industry for many, many decades has a culture of investing in fundamental research and, you know, not going for the home run, but just developing their industry. And on the nuclear side, I see very little investment, in nuclear engineering departments or financial support for students and so on. It's really it's a striking difference to me. And I think that's one reason why we're still speculating about fuel cycles and, you know, there's so much basic data missing. That we need to have an intelligent discussion as far as reactor design goes or reprocessing schemes.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the basic science simply isn't there.
Well, the other piece that has been a drag on the nuclear industry is that there is an awful lot of basic science that is there but is not visible to people like you.
Because it's classified?
Yes.
Well,
and the nuclear industry was born under the cloud of secrecy. Mm-hmm. And when it was finally opened up in the Atomic Energy Act of 1954, it was only opened up to invited players, not necessarily the people that could do the most with the new technology, but the people who the government was comfortable with. And General Electric and Westinghouse are not particularly nuclear companies, although Westinghouse is now because of all the changes it's had over the years. But, you know, they are members of a very large energy industry of which nuclear was only a portion of their offerings.
But don't you think that's a huge burden for an industry that's trying to strike a positive profile? I mean, it doesn't help very much for you to tell me that, well, trust me, it's just classified. I mean...
Oh, I'm not advocating that it should be classified. I was... I have to tread a little bit lightly in some cases, but I was trained as a submarine officer.
Right.
When I went to school... For a lot of historical reasons, which are not necessarily defensible, my training documents were all classified confidential. And I had documents that were a whole course in heat transfer. And, you know, pages were the only thing discussed as the second law of thermodynamics was,
right,
had confidential stamps on top and bottom. It doesn't make sense. But that was a burden on the technology. It isn't the fault of the technology. It isn't the fault of uranium and thorium that somebody decided they should be classified. That's basic science stuff.
As an example, the thorium fuel cycle, this is, I just have to say, I'm really taken by it. I think there are lots of positive aspects to it. But what surprises me is this idea goes back to the mid-1950s.
Oh, sure. Well, I'm taken by an idea of the high-temperature gas reactor, which is
also a pretty old idea.
very old idea. The closed cycle gas turbine dates back to 1946.
And so, you know, I don't know the answer, but my question always is why is this industry so slow? Not only the industry, but also the science.
Well, let
Part
me ask.
It is the classification that you mentioned. But
no, that's only one. I mean, there's I at one time thought about writing a book called "Who Killed Nuclear Power," and there were way too many suspects to cover. As a murder mystery, it would have been too many people. I mean, one suspect that I have, and you may have an interesting response to this, but one of the suspects I have that has slowed the development of nuclear power is various interests who sell other forms of energy, because nuclear power is extremely competitive once the plants are built. And a single nuclear power plant not only prevents the emission of 40,000 tons of CO2 every day, it also prevents the sale of 11,000 tons of coal every day. It is a market displacer.
But in other sectors, let's say in material science, you know, good ideas displace old ideas very efficiently. And so it's hard to believe or understand how in our economic system you can stifle a whole industry.
It depends on how different the new technology is. Nuclear power is not about moving massive quantities of material from place to place. It's not about the ability to arrange particular deals with despots like the petroleum industry is. It's not about drilling deep wells or being able to sustain life under deep ocean or all of the other skills that the petroleum industry develops. And so when somebody comes in and says, oh, by the way, we don't need any atmosphere control equipment, we don't need any pipelines, we don't need any tanker trucks, we don't need any tankers, you know, we don't need to drill to use our technology, what's the response of most industries? They get defensive.
Or they buy up this resource and develop it.
Oh, that's obviously that's a possibility. But again, most of the skill set that makes one successful in nuclear power is a completely different skill and capital investment set than what makes one successful in the oil and gas industry. You would have large portions of the capital assets of the company become almost useless and, as a matter of fact, becoming an expense without any revenue.
Well, I'll leave you with your hypothesis and not comment. I don't know enough to say, but I'd simply suggest there are other contributing factors to the difficulties that
oh, absolutely. I think one of the bigger contributing factors was the desire for giantism. The economy of scale that has made us go from a 60-megawatt plant at Shippingport in 1956 up to 1,000-megawatt plants by 1967, something like that. That scaling up was very difficult and probably slowed down the industry considerably.
Well, and it creates a fewer opportunities for innovation. If you're building something large, then it consumes a lot of capital as well as energy and intellectual capital. Whereas lots of little things, you have small failures, but you can explore successful avenues.
Absolutely agree with that statement.
Yeah.
And actually, I would like to end it on a nice note of agreement. So I appreciate your time, sir. It's been an interesting conversation. And
well, I've enjoyed it as well.
Good. Well, I will send you a link to the post, and hope that we have the opportunity to have another chat sometime in the near future.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I really hate those podcasts that start off with all the loud rock and roll music.
Ooh, I hate screaming commercials.
Especially when you can hear Hawaiian music while you're learning about a Macintosh.
From the island of Maui.
On the Mac Help from Maui podcast.
Listen, you might learn something.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need. Something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. Mm-hmm. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. Mm-hmm. It's atomic. It's atomic. Atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.